This is an NAC podcast. Welcome to an extra edition of the NACOcast. I'm Martin Jones, sitting in for Nick Atkinson. In this supplementary series of the NACOcast, we will feature some of the best presentations made during last season's pre-concert chats here at the National Arts Center in Ottawa. In this edition, Robert Harris speaks on Brahms the Progressive. Enjoy this extra edition of the NACOcast.
Hello, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased that you're here for this pre-concert talk. And I'm pleased that I'm here. You may not be able to see, but about 93% of me is here because I managed to fall and break my arm about a month ago. And I wish I could say it was done in a heroic gesture, but unfortunately I was taking out the garbage. And it doesn't get much more prosaic than breaking your arm while taking out the garbage. And it's been a bit of an annoyance. But on the upside, I figure the video that I took of myself this evening trying to tie my tie with one hand has probably gone viral on YouTube by now. It looked like a Marx Brothers routine. So I have now joined with, you know, cats that, you know, that jump upside down and to delight the people of the world, and with Charlie. So I'll do this just as an aside. I don't know how many of you have ever seen Charlie Bit Me Again on YouTube. It's probably the most downloaded video in the history of YouTube. It's 1 minute long, and I know that your soul is going to be replenished this evening by the great music that we're about to hear. But if you want a little soul dessert when you get home, go to YouTube, search for Charlie Bit Me Again, and you'll see one of the most adorable two children on earth. And maybe my video of me trying to tie my tie will be right up there as well by then. Anyway, the title of the lecture tonight is Brahms the Progressive, and I stole that title, and I'll tell you later from whom I stole it. And it seems wrong, because as we know, or as we think we know, Brahms wasn't a progressive at all. Brahms is a classicist. Brahms, you know, when I was young, and I know I can tell more or less from certain hair tints that are similar to mine, that some of you are my age, you know, we grew up with the three B's, if you remember, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, quite a triumvirate. No one mentions that today, by the way, but in other words, Brahms was one of the great classical pillars of classical music, and the repertoire tonight makes perfect sense in that regard. We've got, you know, Haydn, we've got Mozart, and we have Brahms, two of the great classical masters of the 18th century, and the great classical master of the 19th century. And Brahms is the guy who wrote symphonies and string quartets and chamber music and concertos, the man who reinvested all of these forms of the 1770s and 1780s. And brought them up to date to the 1880s. And the piece we're listening to tonight is 1887. It's actually the last orchestral piece he ever wrote. And as always with these stereotypes and as always with these ideas, they're never entirely wrong. Of course, Brahms did write a lot of those kinds of pieces. But inevitably, those stereotypes hide more than they reveal. You know, and I feel for Brahms. You know, Brahms, to me, he's such an austere figure. You know, nobody, it seems, has ever, even in his lifetime or since, been able to get close to Brahms. You know, that Brahms, you know, that we imagine is the, you know, the guy with the big white beard and, you know, with the cigar and gruff, socially, not awkward, but always keeping people at a distance. And to some extent, his music has that austere quality as well. And again, the piece we'll hear tonight, the double concerto, definitely falls into that. But it's so wrong, I think, you know? It's just so wrong. I just have this feeling I've had it all my life. Brahms is this really tortured individual. And a proof of it, of course, is not just my imagining. It's in the music. I mean, you can take Brahms' world and put it into three periods. And the first and the third share a similarity. And that is the music that Brahms wrote at the beginning of his life when he was in his 20s, mainly for the piano, and the music Brahms wrote at the end of his life, in his 60s, mainly for the piano, is not classical at all. It's not. It is incredibly avant-garde. It's unbelievably inventive, technically, emotionally, formally. It's a complete difference from that Brahms of the symphonies and Brahms of the concertos. The early first three piano sonatas, all written before he was 22, 23, they're unbelievable pieces of music, not well known. I don't have a bit of it, I've got some of the double concerto, but do yourself a favor and listen to, if nothing else, the third piano sonata. Murray Pariah has a version. You won't believe your ears. In the ballads that Brahms wrote, Opus 10, again, he's 21 or 22. The fourth one has a middle section that sounds like Debussy. It sounds like impressionistic music. It has no melody. It sounds like Ravel. It's Debussy, written 6 years before Debussy was born. The early Brahms is so particular. It's not even to call him romantic. I mean, he is, but it's so avant-garde. It's so different from the Brahms that image we have of the sort of the, you know, the master writing his symphonies in the 1860s and the 1870s. And then if you go to the end of Brahms's career, after he's written all of these works, which is the middle period which the piece we're listening to tonight is in, it happens all over again. These incredible late piano pieces, Opus 117, 118, and 119, the Intermezzi, they're all very short or relatively short. Oh my God, they're so dissonant. They sound like Schoenberg. They sound like Debussy again. They sound like modern music, Brahms. And let's remember, Brahms lived until he was until 1897. That's late. We don't think of Brahms being alive 3 years before the 20th century began. We don't think of Brahms being alive 20 years after Edison invented the talking machine. 20 years. The talking machine, the record player had been around for 20 years before Brahms died. You know, Mahler had written three of his symphonies before Brahms died. The Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun had been written 5 years before Brahms died. Brahms lived and worked well into the very beginnings of the 20th century, of 20th century music. The title of the lecture, which I stole from Arnold Schoenberg, either God or devil of, 20th century austere serial 12-tone music, who wrote an essay in 1938 called Brahms the Progressive. Because Schoenberg rightly noted that it was Brahms, those late works of Brahms, those little piano pieces, that in fact were the models for Schoenberg's incredibly groundbreaking piano works written 10, 15 years later. You know, if you look at Opus 23 of Schoenberg or Opus 19, these very tiny little piano pieces where the 12-tone language was basically invented, they're like Brahms's Opus 119, just rewritten 10 years later. I mean, that is the model that Schoenberg used, and he admitted it, and he wrote an essay about it. And he wrote the essay because he was sick and tired, as I have, of Brahms constantly being seen as this arch-conservative, reactionary composer trying to hold back musical progress, basically trying somehow to be Canute, holding back the tides of the new music that had been invented by Liszt and Wagner and Busoni, and that sort of became so identified with the late 19th century. Schoenberg felt, and I do as well, that in fact Brahms actually was more far-reaching than a Liszt or Wagner had ever dreamed of being. And I think that's all true. But it's still true that Brahms has this image that clings to him. You know, it's like it's like Velcro. He can't get rid of it, right? And that's because in the middle part of his career, he did in fact turn away from those incredible experiments of his early years, and before the experiments of his later years. It's interesting. Brahms decided to retire from composing in 1890 when he was 57. 50-something, just 3 years after this piece that we're going to hear tonight was written. This piece is the end of the middle period that I'm about to describe. It's the very last piece for orchestra he ever wrote. You know, and I've thought about this a lot. Composers don't retire, you know? It's like saying a rosebush retires. You know, like a rosebush keeps having roses because that's what it does. It's not a choice. It's a natural thing. And composers, there have been composers that have retired, but remarkably few. Rossini retired and then wrote more music at the end of his life. Composers keep working. Whether the music they write at the end of their lives is good or bad, they don't stop. They can't stop. But Brahms was going to stop. He had decided to stop. That is really more unusual than we think. You know, I was... on the Sunday edition, I think last week, with Michael Enright talking about Philip Glass, you know, and Philip Glass is a really interesting guy because he had never stopped. I mean, he's 75 now, and the amount of music that he has written is just unbelievable. We think of Glass as the composer of Einstein on the Beach. That's 74, you know. Those operas for which he's so famous, they're 30 years ago. And he writes every day because that's what you do if you're a composer. You don't have any choice. So for Brahms to decide to quit, he gave it up again. He gave up that decision. And as I say, all of these late pieces that I was talking about came after that decision. Something really interesting had to be going on in his mind, in my opinion, because there's a fatigue. There's something that he's tired of. And I think he got tired of being Brahms. He got tired of being the Brahms who was cast in these debates. So there's no doubt that if you picked up a newspaper in, you know, Hamburg or Berlin or Paris in the 1860s or the 1870s, you would see this tremendous debate about the forces of the music of the future. You know, and that was Wagner, and that was Liszt. People who were taking music into new dimensions. And then against them was Brahms. Brahms was always held out as the man who was not necessarily holding back these forces, but was providing them counterweight to them. And the problem with that is that dispute was not of Brahms' making. He never, ever became part of that dispute. Hans, the critics, people speaking for him, you created this dichotomy. It was never his. He was trapped by it. This is my theory, is that Brahms quit because he was trapped into this dichotomy, into this sort of role that, although it was partly his, obviously he wrote these pieces, but it was never him. And he was trapped into something. Okay, I will now make an apology. I'll make an apology to you, and, you know, because, you know, who wants to be in bad taste, you know, when you can hardly wait to see what I'm going to say, don't you? when you're talking to a group like this. But I got to tell you, I detest absolutely everything that is associated with Richard Wagner. I detest him. I detest his music. I detest what he stood for. I detest what he did to music. He destroyed classical music. If classical music is having trouble today, it's Wagner's fault. Okay? And I'll tell you why. And Brahms was roped into this press agentry, gimmicky, fake dispute about the music of the future that Wagner launched to aggrandize himself and to make himself into, you know, the artist of the millennia. Now, Wagner was very much a press agentry kind of guy. He didn't miss a trick. Either you love him or you hate him. You can't deny that Wagner was brilliant at creating an image for himself. And Brahms was exactly the opposite, basically a shy person. He was roped into this false dispute, and it's completely false. You know, Wagner wasn't the music of the future, okay? And my proof, now I'm getting angry, okay? Here's my proof. Arnold Schoenberg did not write his essay, Wagner the Progressive. And Arnold Schoenberg knew what progressive meant, because Arnold Schoenberg, like him or hate him, was the guy who understood what the progressive forces in music were. And he created the most progressive, difficult, forward-looking language in the history of music, single-handedly. As I say, whether you hate it or like it, it's true. And he who did that says that Brahms was the guy who taught him how to do that. Brahms was the man who in the 19th century, found the forces that would take music into the 20th century. He found the forces harmonically. You can hear it in those last pieces. But he also found the forces in a formal manner. This is what Schoenberg, this is why Schoenberg is more Brahms than he will ever be Wagner. Because Schoenberg and all the composers that he influenced, Berg, Webern, the Boulezes, the Stockhausens, all of the who have come later, understood that music can't just be emotion. It can't just be sensual. Music from the day Western music was created was a combination of, yes, great beauty and great sensuousness, but also form, structure, discipline. I was reading something about Bach just a couple of days ago and found this wonderful quote by Gottfried Leibniz, who was a philosopher who lived almost exactly the same time that Bach did. And Leibniz has my favorite definition of music I've ever read in my life. A weird one, but an interesting one. And Leibniz basically said that music, listening to music, is the pleasure we get from counting without realizing we're counting. In other words, music is the pleasure we get from hearing structure in sound that our brains unconsciously hear, process, and gain pleasure from. So that the pleasure we get from music is partly the pleasure of form, the pleasure of structure, the pleasure of counting, the pleasure of, you know, of hearing structure, hearing a form of unity. And this is why, of course, the philosophers of those time felt that music was close to godliness. That in fact, music, and this is an idea that goes back to Pythagoras, that music, because it has that structure to it, it's like the world. The world has a structure to it as well. You know, when you walk outside those doors and you see the gorgeous canal and the leaves and the colors, you know, it's not random. It's, you know, whether you're a believer or whether you're an atheist, it doesn't make any difference. There's no doubt that there's structure there, that there's some sort of order in the world. And the philosophers of the 18th century found that in music, that order of the world was reproduced in sound. And Brahms, what Brahms continued in the 19th century was that idea. That was the idea that Brahms continued. So he was, in fact, conserving something. But he wasn't. It's not the forms, and it's not the fact that he wrote concertos, and it's not that, you know, that, and Beethoven wrote concertos, and he wrote symphonies, and Haydn wrote symphonies. It's that Brahms, as well as having this deeply emotional sense to him, which you can hear in those early pieces, he also had a constructive sense. He was such a brilliant composer that his mind couldn't put aside the composer's need to order. The music of the future that Wagner championed was basically music without order. What is interesting about Wagnerian operas is that, you know, the structure in them is childish, right? It's those leitmotifs. It's like basically when you hear, it's like a Pavlov and his dog, right? So when, you know, you hear Siegfried, you go, okay, I get it, boom. You know, it's like you're four, okay? In other words, you know, that's not the way music's supposed to work. You'll hear in a second the way music is supposed to work is that you take a theme like da-da-da-da in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and then transform it 150 times, 200 times over the course of 7 minutes so that it's not exactly the same every single time. The whole point is that your mind can see it move. And Mozart did this and Haydn did this and Wagner didn't do this because Wagner's idea about music was to take that sensual aspect of it, its ability to move us, which is undoubtedly real, you know, and to make that the only thing that's important. So the reason that I detest Wagner so much, if I may say so, and I even got close to what he was like as a person. That's like, forget that. I mean, he could have been Albert Schweitzer, and I still would have detested him, okay? Like, he could have been Mother Teresa, and I still could have. And the reason for that is that Wagner tried to destroy the most important thing, or one of the most important things about music, whether he did it intentionally or not, and that is that constructive bit. The fact that music works on our brains and on our spirits and on our souls so beautifully because it combines that beauty of sensuousness with that power of construction. You know, I found one quote of Wagner's that interests me amazingly, and that he was not he found composing difficult. And he certainly found composing, you know, the standard Western way of music very difficult. And at one point, he's working on something, and he writes in his notebook, you know, I can't even write a simple modulation, you know, without effort. You know, Mendelssohn would kill himself laughing. This is what he's written on his note. Mendelssohn would kill himself laughing. Mendelssohn, the Jew, I might add, would kill himself laughing if he could see how difficult the difficulties I'm having with this simple chord progression. So I'm not sure, to be quite honest, whether Wagner's ideas about music came from his inadequacies as a composer. You know, because I'm crazy and about Wagner, I'm prepared to believe anything negative about him. So I'm quite happy to believe that, in fact, that entire, those all 16 hours of The Ring are there because he couldn't write one decent chord progression. But that's probably going a bit too far. But there's no doubt that Wagner, that, so the music of the future, that Brahms, you know, found himself, you know, Brahms was a composer. He wasn't a polemicist, you know? And he found himself all of a sudden being, you know, categorized, I mean, being trapped into being the anti-Wagner, right? And he didn't want to be the pro-Wagner, and he didn't want to be the anti-Wagner. He didn't want to be the pro or anti anything. He just wanted to write his music. So this is why, I mean, again, I can't quote chapter and verse or letters of Brahms that say this. You know, it just seems to me to be the way his career unfolded. But we still have to deal with that middle period Brahms, right? And it interests me tremendously because, as I said before, in the early days, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you know, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, think of what that means. Like, that's a pretty powerful triumvirate. So that in the early part of this century, the 30s, the 40s, into the 60s, Brahms was seen as this sort of, as I say, this pillar of the Western tradition. And it really interests me why nobody says that anymore. No one ever says that anymore. And part of that reason, I think, is that the rise of Gustav Mahler. Because Brahms was seen as sort of the end point of that sort of Western classical tradition. And by that, I mean the tradition that uses symphonies and as a means of expression before people got to know Mahler's work well. And you got to remember that well into the 60s, the 1960s, Mahler's work was not well known at all. I mean, we hear more Mahler today than he ever was played in his lifetime. And it was the recording that did that, and it was specifically the recordings of Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic that made Mahler into more of a household name. And my feeling is that when Mahler became better known, he took over the place that Brahms had previously occupied as sort of the last gasp of that classical tradition, which is why we don't talk about the three Bs anymore. And there's no doubt, you know, that this middle period Brahms, the Brahms of the symphonies, of the concertos, is difficult, you know, because, you know, not everything he wrote was successful. And if you actually look through, you know, the scores of these works, boy, they're tortured, you know. They're really torturous because the musical ideas are not played out easily. They're played out with a certain amount of, not hesitation, but weight to them. It's interesting. If you talk to pianists, you know, there's always, you know, great, what's the hardest piece to play in the repertoire? And, you know, from a technical point of view, you know, most people come to the conclusion that Rachmaninoff's Third Concerto is technically the most difficult. If you remember Shine, remember that movie with Geoffrey Rush? That was the piece that basically took him over the edge because it's so incredibly difficult. But when you talk to pianists, and I've read many interviews about, like, what's the most difficult one to play? Not just technically, but what's the most difficult to get across? What's the most difficult musically? They basically fall over each other between two choices. And the first choice is Brahms' first piano concerto, and the second choice is Brahms' second piano concerto. And that's because technically, I mean, this guy must have had hands the size of this lectern. You know, I mean, just physically to try and play all the notes in a Brahms piano concerto is quite a feat. But having played them all, you're nowhere. I mean, you play all the notes in Rachmaninoff 3 sort of in the right place, and the music will create the effect that you and Rachmaninoff wanted to create, more or less. Brahms, not at all. I mean, you can put all the notes in the right place and the thing will just fall flat, because finding within this music, the musical ideas, it's hard to describe, but it's, I mean, and I'm just an amateur pianist, but I mean, I have the scores to both of these pieces and, you know, just playing them over or trying to play them, they're just so austere and they're so demanding, you know? So you really work hard. So there is an element of the Brahms of this middle period, and as they say, that's what we're going to be hearing tonight, that is austere and is classical. That's why I gave it up, I think, you know? That's what I say. This is why this resignation of Brahms, his resignation letter, is so telling to me, because after he resigned, in effect, which was 3 years after this piece that we'll hear tonight was written, he couldn't pull it off. He was forced back into music, and he was forced back originally by the Mühlfeld brothers, these beautiful clarinet players, and he started to investigate the lower instruments, the lower sounding instruments, and then eventually came back to himself as a pianist. But when he came back to himself, as they say in these late works, the Brahms of the symphonies was long gone, boy. And I get the feeling, again, I'm making this up, but it's hard not to escape the feeling that Brahms had finally jettisoned, because by this time Wagner was dead and Liszt was dead and this whole bogus fight about music of the future was over. You know, Wagner was established, Brahms was established. You know, as I say, Mahler had started to write, Debussy had started to write, Schoenberg had started to write. This whole nonsense about the music of the future was done. So he didn't have to worry about that. And he wrote these pieces, as I say, these extraordinarily gorgeous, bitter, sort of autumnal pieces that you have to believe are closer to his real heart as a composer. However, even in the piece that we're going to listen to tonight, there are elements of that. It's not the most successful piece he wrote. Some people love it. I love it. It's not Clara Schumann, you know, the only woman he loved, was disappointed in this. And there's lots of interesting reasons why. He wrote the piece basically as a peace offering to his longtime friend Josef Joachim and Doug Sturdivant, who's helps run these lectures and had hired me, reminded me that there's a connection that Joachim taught somebody eventually a train of music teachers that ended in Pinchas Zukerman. So that in fact, Joachim, the man to whom this concerto was dedicated and written for, is sort of the great-great-great-great-grandparent of Pinky's teacher. So there's a real connection between the two. And Joachim and Brahms had a falling out because Joachim had gotten divorced and Brahms had supported his wife. And I mean, like if TMZ was involved there, you know, we'd be watching this on Entertainment Tonight, you know, the Joachim divorce, you know, what Brahms said. So Brahms wrote this as a peace offering, in effect, to Joachim, and he presented it. But the truth of the matter is, interestingly to me, so it's a double concerto, and that's unusual because, you know, writing a concerto is hard. Writing a concerto for two instruments is really hard because now you've got two voices, you've got to balance them between each other, you've got to balance them with the orchestra. This idea that the concerto is, you know, man against the nature, the man against society. God, if I read that one more time, I'm going to scream, right? In other words, you know, because you've got the soloist out in front of the orchestra and, you know, this idea that it's the individual pitted against society. It's just not true. If that were true, then the themes that the soloist had and the themes that the orchestra had would be different. And they're never different. They're always the same. So, in fact, a concerto is about the varied relationships between individuals and society. Sometimes they're in opposition. Sometimes they play together. Sometimes they support each other. That's what makes concertos fascinating to me, is that how different the relationships are. But what interests me about this one is that this should have been a cello concerto. He should have just, I mean, I'm sorry that Joachim got divorced, because if Joachim hadn't got divorced, he wouldn't have had to feel that he had to write the part for him, and he could have just written the cello part, which is so gorgeous, and clearly what he wanted to write, and this would be one of the most popular pieces in the repertoire. Every time the two instruments enter, the cello enters first. Almost every single time in the three movements. Check it out tonight. It's always the cello who speaks first, and the violin who follows. Normally it's the other way around. You know, the violin's the high instrument, and we go from high to low. That's just the way our brains work. Not in this case. And that beautiful low sound that came to dominate the late Brahms, I think, really got started in this piece. So I could go on, but I won't. I just wanted to let you hear some of how Brahms sort of dealt with this, because you get the feeling that it is somewhat conventional, I got to admit. I mean, for Brahms, the first movement is a sonata allegro form, and that basically means that there are two main themes. Haydn, in effect, invented this idea. And the whole point of the first movement is that two of these themes are presented in opposition to one another, and through the course of the movement, they come into harmony with one another. So it's a struggle. That's what the first movement of a sonata form is. It's a struggle between opposites that eventually become unified. And Brahms never really varied from that idea. He accepted that basically idea. He exposed it and he worked it out differently. And the first movement of the double concerto certainly works that way. But what's interesting is two things. Number one, and this again wasn't unique to Brahms, but it's sort of interesting nonetheless. These two themes that are in opposition to each other, they're exactly the same. They're actually made of exactly the same notes, disguised so that if I didn't tell you, you wouldn't realize it really until you looked at the score and say, well, that's interesting. So the opening theme, which you read at the beginning, don't have to play it yet, very, very sort of magisterial. Da-dum-bum, da-dum-bum, bum-bum-bum-ba-da-da-da-da. Really, really heavy, right? And so it's three notes. Da-dum-bum. The second theme is da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They sound like completely different themes, but they're the same three notes. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He's in fact written the theme twice. It's the same theme. It's not two themes. It's two aspects to the same theme. Now that's really, as they say, Brahms didn't invent this, Beethoven did this, Mozart did this, but Brahms does it very, very distinctly and toys with an idea which he didn't carry through. Because he's got two instruments, you know? So you figure, maybe I got an idea. Why maybe one theme should be associated with one instrument and another theme should be associated with the second instrument? Now, that would be a radical idea in concerto writing. And he didn't do it, but he almost did it, okay? So I want you to listen to the opening, just the opening of the first movement, which you'll hear in a second. And you can see him toy with this fabulous idea. And as I say, in a concerto, sonata allegro movement, you have a first movement, a second movement, and the juxtaposition and the working out of that can take 12 minutes, 13 minutes, 18 minutes. Brahms completely collapses it. It happens within 2 minutes. Anyway, I'm going to talk, try not to be disruptive, but take a listen to the beginning of the Brahms. There's that first theme, right? Da-bum-bum. Now it stops. And the cello, always first, has this long cadenza where he comments on this theme, right? So beautiful. Like the piece is stopped before it started, right? And it goes on, too. So where are we in time? We're in nowhere land. Like time has stopped at this point. It's a very unusual way to start a concerto because you're supposed to be forward moving. But Brahms is looking at something else here. So could you tell all the people outside to stop talking for a second? Da, 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 da. That's the theme. Da, da, dum. So he's playing with those notes. It's almost like a Bach solo cello suite at this point. And you have no idea what's coming next. You have no idea. And listen what comes next. He has them played a pizzicato. And he holds this last note. And the orchestra comes in. and it's the second theme. Like, the second theme shouldn't be here for 7 minutes. And the second theme, which is the first theme, is presented to us, right? And then the violin takes that up. So here's this great idea that he has. Make the first theme the cellos, make the second theme the violin. He's collapsed the entire movement, 20 minutes. And now we've gotten that opposition between these two of them so beautifully. Now the cello and the violin talk to one another. They're fighting these two ideas. As I say, it's all about relationships, right? I mean, is there a more extraordinary opening to a concerto in history? No. Okay? This is Brahms being the great constructor, you know? You know? The conservative? Hardly. I mean, this is just amazing opening. And listen to this. It goes from violin to cello, and then cello back up to violin. He's turned them into one instrument. It's like they're one instrument now, not fighting, the same instrument, right? And they build, and they build. It's like the piece is over, right? We should be getting up and clapping now, right? And instead, he starts the exposition, right? Okay, good. So there's that first theme again. Da, da. And unfortunately, if you want my opinion, you can fade that one. We now have sort of a conventional first movement of a concerto. And that first theme plays for a while, and then the second theme comes back. But that opening, the possibilities that Brahms didn't quite capture are so amazing to me. Now, that notion that you have the instruments play before the theme starts, he'd done that in the second piano concerto. He does exactly the same thing, but it's short. What he's done is, they say, he's in fact composed the whole first movement in 3 minutes, and then, unfortunately, takes 12 more minutes to compose it all over again, right? You know? And maybe he just didn't know where to go, and maybe I'm making all of this up, but I'm not making it up because I just heard it. And it's amazing. That second theme, that introduction of the second theme early, is such a brilliant idea because he's got two instruments. So what was he supposed to do after that cello solo? So let's assume we're Brahms, okay? And we start that with da-da-bum, da-da-dum, and then the cello comes in. So we know we're coming back to that idea in a few seconds. And the cello has this long, beautiful solo. Okay, and so you and I are now Brahms, and we've got to the point in the piece where he's finished the cello solo, and the next bar is blank. There's nothing there, okay? What do you write? Do you go back to da, da, da again? You can't, because you've already established that idea. You've had the cello sort of emotionally take it to town and find its depths. You certainly can't go back to it and then have the violin do the same thing. That's impossible. And so the light bulb goes on, right? Give him the second theme. Put the second theme in there and have the violin comment on that. To me, it's a small point, but it's a brilliant point to me. And that, to me, that's the Brahms. That's the Brahms, the constructive Brahms, who is still writing concerti, you know, and not the whole, and then, as I say, the rest of it isn't necessarily as successful. But it just shows to me how much that idea of Brahms, the conservative, not just the classicist, is wrong. So when you're listening to this, I mean, again, the concert, you'll hear the Haydn, you'll hear the Mozart. On some level, the Brahms will sound the same. But if you really listen into it, it isn't the same. And especially listen to how he plays off his three protagonists, basically the cello, the violin, and the orchestra. And in fact, even within the orchestra, Brahms divides the winds and the strings. It's like a 12-person drama, this piece, you know? And everybody has got their role to play. So I think it's certainly worth your while. Anyway, I think we have a time. If you have any questions, it's about 22, and I want to give you time, and I want myself time to get ready to go to the concert. Are there any questions that anybody has off the top of their head? Okay, well then, thank you very much, and enjoy yourself. I know you're going to be fun. Thank you.
This has been an NAC podcast. You'll find more NAC podcasts, including the NACOcast sister podcast, Explore the Symphony, at nacpodcasts.ca. You can subscribe to NAC Podcasts for free by searching on National Arts Center in the iTunes Music Store. For free access to over 250 full-length, high-quality recordings of the NAC Orchestra, from Bach to Bartok, check out nacmusicbox.ca. Send your comments and questions to nacpodcasts@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. That's all for this supplementary edition of the NACOcast. I'm Martin Jones, sitting in for Nick Atkinson. Goodbye for now from Canada's National Arts Centre in Ottawa.